What are some of the legal challenges associated with human security, and what policies could and should be implemented in order to improve the security that's existent today?
You mean the legal...
The international court challenges.
Yeah. I mean, the International Criminal Court is a new invention that has a lot of implications for international relations. You know, it's a global institution dealing with, human rights violations, particularly genocide and also war crimes and things like that. I think the purpose is to hold state leaders and others and their allies to account for what they do, especially when they massacre or slaughter their own people. I think that the mission is noble. It is an important international instrument. But at the same time, we also have to be very careful about using this policy instrument. Simply because just because you care about people does not mean that the policy strategy or instrument can be very effective. Simply, you're dealing with state leaders and government officials who have power. And you cannot, the International Criminal Court does not have any enforcement power. So ideally, yes, it would be good if the International Court could have these enforcement power to pursue their own cases. But at the same time, it's a toothless organization. And it can also, when you push it too hard, I have not seen very strong cases supporting the argument that retributive justice and criminal justice is something that is very effective at the international level, because you deal with powerful people. And usually when powerful people are under threat, they feel the need to keep fighting and to entrench their position and make even democratic transition more difficult. That's my understanding of it based on, my observation over the years. So international criminal justice is based on the assumptions that the wrongdoers, the human rights violators, must be punished in order to deter a future action similar to, criminal action. But at the same time, it's difficult to deal with, even to arrest, let's say, the president of Sudan. How would you arrest the president of Sudan?
I mean, the complexity associated with even attempting to arrest the president of Sudan is ultimately non-existent. Mm. What approach would he use to even attempt to get a hold of him?
Yeah.
He has his own team of people, armed forces. In order to get to him, you'd have to get through many entities, many people involved.
Yeah, and at the same time, knowing that if he lost power, that would be the end of his regime, or the end of his life, or, you never know. Gaddafi is a good example, right? So knowing that everything is at stake, he will fight to the end. And that means suffering for ordinary people. So in other words, democratic transition does not look very good. So I think we need to be more careful, from my perspective, that our good intentions do not always translate into policy effectiveness. So we need to be mindful of our idealism as well as the reality on the ground. And I'm very critical of authoritarian regimes and repression. I'm mindful of that. But sometimes we make things worse by pursuing certain policies that don't work. So we need to be more realistic about the way we implemented our policy decisions or instrument.
Dr. Pugh, one of your next publications, Peace and Security in the Asia Pacific, provides a critical review of the established theoretical perspectives relevant to contemporary peace and security studies in the light of recent experiences. This publication covers over 20 theoretical perspectives on peace and security in the Asian Pacific. Taking all of these perspectives into account, what would you say are the top most effective theoretical perspectives? And I know it's a complex question, and it's a question that could end up taking hours to answer. But if you had to sum it up in a simple overview that would take a few minutes, what would you say to someone who wants a brief overview of the main theoretical perspectives that would be considered to be the most effective as of today?
As you said, to answer your question would take a whole day.
Yes.
Because we have to walk through each theoretical perspective. And, you know, each time I teach, I have a class, or I start a new course or a new class, I always tell my student, ask not which theory is correct, but ask what each theory can teach us. And that is, each theory has strengths and weaknesses. No theory is correct. No theory is completely wrong. We can learn a lot from every theoretical perspective. There are strengths, there are insights that we can absorb. So, you know, my approach is more eclectic in the sense that I recognize the strength of each theory and also its weaknesses. So what I'm trying to do in that book is to make a case for, you know, trying to understand each theory and trying to draw strength from that theory and see if you can synthesize and learn from each theory. And my argument is that we need to really build on the strength of a lot of theories. So that's why I'm not a feminist, but I'm sympathetic toward feminism, because feminism offers some good insight that would help us learn about security and also particularly human security, right? But at the same time, feminism does not really address certain realities, in my view, that stand in the way of what the feminists want to do. So it's quite complex. That's why I call my theory complex realist institutionalism, because it's complex. The world is complex. And realism to the extent that, you know, the use of force is still relevant in contemporary world politics. And to wish power away is unrealistic. Power matters. And that's why the use of force is still going to be relevant in the near future. And, you know, I just don't see how the use of force will come to an end anytime soon. But at the same time, I also recognize the importance of the democratic peace thesis proposition, that democracies tend to coexist more peacefully with each other. And that's a liberal perspective, and I find that perspective quite convincing in a sense that a democracy or democratic regime tend to be more understanding of each other and tend to find peaceful solution to their own problems, including territorial dispute. But at the same time, to wish power away from democratic states, I just don't find it convincing either. So power matters.
Yes, power certainly does matter. Another question I wanted to ask you is one pertaining to the issues involving Russia.
Russia, yeah.
President Putin is a major driving force. He, the amount of power that he has is very clear. He also has Russia, has a relationship with North Korea, China, and then Iran as well. Where do you see the direction of Putin in terms of international relations and affairs? Do you think that his actions will become a threat to us Canadians?
Yeah. I don't see it that way. I think Putin is quite realistic. You know, I mean, we can debate all day about what Putin's strategy is all about. I see Putin as more being a defensive realist in the sense that, you know, he's not a democrat, we all know. He's an authoritarian leader operating in a more close, not open political system. You know, he's the strong man of Russia. At least he projects himself to be that way. But at the same time, I see a high degree of vulnerability on his part, feeling threatened from others, especially, you know, the use of force. That's why one of the things that I would say, that the use of force can be counterproductive. the more Western power use force to even protect people, the more other authoritarian leaders outside the Western sphere of influence feel threat that, you know, this is what the West is trying to do, using human security as an excuse to dominate other countries. And my reading of Putin is quite different from some scholars, as a student of international security. I see him as being defensive, vulnerable, pushing back, and, you know, he's also, the Russian leader is a proud person, a proud man. After all, Russia is a great power. You don't kowtow to other powers easily. So how we deal with Putin is a big question mark, and I feel that the war, the use of force in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and all of that can be perceived as a threat to the rest of the world. And that's what concerns me.
Another question I wanted to ask in regards to your work and your publication consists of the following. International democracy assistance in peace building is another one of your publications. Mm-hmm. This book explains why international donors may succeed in putting war-torn countries on the path of democratic transition and negative peace, but fail to consolidate the gains they make. Why is it that you believe these international donors fail to consolidate the gains they make as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, there are two big transitions or phases in the process of democratization. One, we call it democratic transition or democratic emergence. The other one is democratic consolidations. And the first phase is easier to deal with. The second phase is so difficult that donors have had a lot of problems trying to consolidate the democracy or democratic gain. The first one is easy. It can be done simply through intervention, meaning that you put an end to conflict. The case of Cambodia is a good example. And then you introduce democratic ideas and systems, and then you hold elections and people compete. And, you know, one of the titles, right, turning the battlefield into a ballot box. That simply, it's easy. Right. All you need to do is send peacekeeping troops, monitoring the electoral process, getting former factions' enemies to compete in the electoral process. But even that, I'm not saying it's easy. It is tough. But the next phase, democratic consolidation, is the most challenging. You know, the democracy doesn't grow overnight. It's a long-term process, and it takes decades. It takes centuries in Europe, you know, and it takes a long time, generally speaking. And it needs a lot of resources to make democratic institutions work. Let's say the judicial system, the court system, right? The court system, for it to work, based on my experience in Canada, is so expensive. And for poor countries who don't have a lot of resources to make the court system work, it's almost impossible. Resource scarcity is a big challenge. That's why the judicial system in war-torn countries, or countries that have experienced war, tend to be extremely corrupt. And it doesn't work. And it has become a political instrument of the regime or the party in power. And, you know, once a party has achieved domination or dominance, it's very difficult for that party to give up power either. So the electoral process can face a lot of setback because, you know, institutional structure are not strong enough to ensure fair play among the political system. So once a political party managed to control, it's not easy to give up power, because by trying to control the political process or the political structure, sometimes you have to be very abusive. And as you become abusive, you know that if you give up power, you will not be alive, or you will not stay in power.
It's oftentimes seen as a weakness. Yeah. So in terms of the judicial system, you oftentimes see the justice system in these war-torn countries. And as you mentioned previously, of course, the people who have the resources and the power, along with the authority, will have accessibility to use the judicial system as they please, as opposed to those who are suffering as a result of poverty or are vulnerable and susceptible to certain circumstances as a result of not having that financial mean and that financial security, oftentimes are left without any help, any assistance, any support in order to be even provided with any outcome or even to be have their voices heard by the judicial system.
Yeah, and that is the problem.